Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I am joined by Mustafa Henaway. Mustafa is a Canadian-born Egyptian and a longtime community organizer at the Immigrant Workers Center in Montreal, where he has been organizing for justice for immigrant/migrant workers for over two decades. He is also a researcher and PhD candidate at Concordia University, and he is the author of the newest book, Essential Work, Disposable Workers. And it's my pleasure to welcome Mustafa to The Deep Dive. How are you doing today?
I'm good, and thank you so much, Philip, for having me on The Deep Dive. It's a real honor.
Oh, thank you, man. It's I was telling you a little bit before we started recording how essential, no pun intended, given the title of the book, your work is, both as an organizer, a community organizer, and now as an author and scholar in a space that, for all the bluster of populist politics globally, doesn't usually get the sort of scholarly and also compassionate attention that I think you gave it. So, you know, I really want to start there with, you know, your work at the Immigrant Workers Center and A, how you came to doing this type of work, and then B, how the work that you do led to the book, Essential Work, Disposable Workers.
Okay, so I mean, how I came to organize with immigrant migrant workers, I mean, it really goes back to my own personal experience. And one of the things that I realized was, you know, I'd been active in the student movement and sort of progressive politics and the anti-globalization movement. And, you know, was around sort of these progressive or more, you know, leftist circles, and everyone talking about, you know, the working class and the working class. And, you know, I looked to my own family and my own upbringing. You know, my dad's a taxi driver. My mom's a, you know, school bus driver. I'd been working odd jobs since high school in a grocery store. And, you know, when people talked about class and felt it never reflected me and never reflected my own personal experience, but that in the community around me. And that was constantly ignored and, you know, didn't really reflect on it theoretically or abstractly or, you know, but, you know, at the gut level. And, you know, one of the things, you know, that came up constantly is like, we have to organize workers. And then I said, well, I should be organizing folks like my dad. You know, I should be, you know, these are all brilliant people. You know, there's the puns around, if you need a doctor, you're better off calling a taxi driver than going to the hospital. And a lot of them were old activists in the countries they came from. And so I was part of a group called OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. We organized with taxi drivers, right? And sort of, and this was back in 2004. And to say that these are workers, you know, they're not just, you know, self-employed, you know, this is sort of the pre-gig economy, right? And they're really exploited. You know, people are working 6-7 days a week, 12-14 hours a day, and no one wants to organize them. And when they do organize, they shut down the city. They shut down highways. And this was a huge portion of the racialized workforce. And so that was really my own coming into that kind of, to that experience of organizing immigrant workers. It's actually, I remember that was pretty funny. The first person, one of the things that we did was fought tickets. You know, we called them unjust because a lot of taxi drivers get tickets for doing things that you wouldn't get if you were at a normal workplace, right? So a lot of taxi drivers get tickets for double parking. Usually they're off to the coffee shop to use the bathroom. So, you know, if you're in a normal workplace, going to the bathroom is a right. But for taxi drivers, it's a punishment. So the way that they were being penalized. So I remember one of the first things we did was we fought thousands of dollars worth of my dad's municipal tickets. And to me, it began that long journey. And when I moved to Montreal, I became, you know, I felt affinity with the Immigrant Workers Center there in 2007. And they were organizing around domestic workers primarily, but there was the idea of really branching out, working with taxi drivers, finding, you know, organizing with textile and garment workers. And so I'd slowly become involved, and it's been sort of my home ever since. So that's really how I got to the Immigrant Workers Center. It was kind of really out of my own personal journey, you know, and also within, you know, social movements. And I mean, the book, it's, you know, even though the title is sort of this post-pandemic or during the pandemic, you know, essential work, disposable workers, the book really was an idea since 2017 and 2018, and that kind of the Trump moment, right? And it was the conception of the book was really kind of thinking through why the left, especially in, you know, in North America and Europe, you know, you had this great moment in 2015, 2016, huge amounts of solidarity with migrants and refugees, you know, the Solidarity Summer in Germany in 2015, when nearly a million refugees made their way to Germany. You had the migrant caravans going north. You had the refugees welcome movement here in Canada. And all of that had turned, and, you know, a lot of voices on the left saying, well, if we have no borders, the world is, you know, the sky is going to collapse. And not only that, we can't welcome everyone. And really this idea of a nationalist position, as opposed to based on sort of an ethno, you know, a xenophobic way of playing catch up to the far right, and saying, as opposed to saying, you know, actually, these, you know, often invisibilized, precarious migrants are a source of our renewal. And, you know, and as a left, you know, being a voice of the oppressed, organizing with the oppressed, as opposed to actually trying to bring them to say no, that are that, you know, you had a portion of the left saying that what's the most important or what's strategically important is to play catch up to the far right. So the book really came out of that context and really trying to show, no, that's not our political project. That can't be our vision. That's not a vision of liberation. That's not a vision of humanism at this moment.
I want to jump on that a little bit, you know, that sort of reckoning on the left that you highlighted, that seemed to be, you know, moving closer to parroting lockstep with some opinions on the right, though different language, right? Because it made me think about how when you were talking about growing up and seeing a left that didn't organize people like your dad and your mom, right? Like the conversations that were engaged around workers and organizing didn't seem to fit in the type of people like your mom and your dad, and I'm sure others in your community. You know, I could tell a similar story, though the labor is different. My mom actually was in a union, but she was in a healthcare union and stuff like that. And New York's a little different. But it still seems to me like there's a real challenge on highlighting and thinking about who is a worker, quote unquote, who is working class. And you see this across those lines that you highlighted on the left, and you see it on the right, right? Where particularly with the rise of someone like a Donald Trump, you know, there's all this hand wringing about white working class, right? From a US perspective. And, you know, when people talked about how, oh, the elites, the liberals are leaving working class people behind, I'm like, who do you think are all these black and brown people who are voting for, you know, more Democratic candidates, right? They're clearly workers and working class as well. So there's such a split there. So I wanted to get, give you a chance to go a little deeper into that schism that seems to exist between who we truly count as a worker, working class, and how that affects both class and race when we have these conversations.
I mean, it's definitely an important question and debate. And I think, a lot of what I try to unearth in the book is really that. And, because, there was, in the post-war world, the post-Second World War, the left saw, this focus on industrial unions sort of in the auto sector and manufacturing and this kind of white working class as being the, at the heart of, a radical left politic or and for, progressive strategy in terms of progressive politics. And, what I try to say in the book is that, well, one, it's historically, it's also inaccurate. I mean, and unfortunately the book didn't get to go into it, it's now left on the side pages for a future project. If you look at the history of even the labor movement in places like the US or Canada, it's always been black and brown workers who've been, and immigrant labor at the heart, right? So if you look at the West Coast, in the Ghadar movement, for example, where Sikh workers were organizing on the farms in the early 1900s with the help of radical unions like the IWW. If you look at the history of the garment worker organizing in New York City, where it was mostly immigrant women labor, right? If you look at black workers organizing in even the auto plants in Detroit in the 60s and 70s. So there's always been that story that's been left out in terms of the kind of the diversity of the working class, but also sort of neglecting their power, right? And so creating this false debate and this false narrative. And I think it doesn't serve any, radical left project, any project around, liberation. And if you jump to sort of these contemporary moment, and what I try to argue is that it's, as hard as it is, as difficult as the task may be, if you look at late stage capitalism, the vast majority of working people who are left out of trade unions or of the political process are at the heart of a capital accumulation at this moment, right? But even regardless of that, they're still organizing and they're still fighting. And so we have to actually see them as being core to that idea of labor and of labor renewal. But that means, how do we rethink what is a trade union, the role of trade unions, how we conceive of class? And I think, there's this idea that if you mix in, this idea that especially, oppression like race is sort of always separate from our ideas of class, because there's always this idea, and unfortunately parts of the left, spews, kind of a universalism, right? That our idea or conception of class is universal, right? And once you throw in ideas of race and gender, that, that splits the idea of class. And I try to say, no, it actually accentuates it. It actually makes it more accurate to an understanding of how class is lived, how class is formed, especially in advanced capitalist countries. There was never just this universal idea. And even if you look back, even when people look back, the idea of a working class was always a political project. It was never a sort of the academic way of saying it, was never just an ontological sort of, sense of being. Class was always formed. And, Marx even writes this. And if you look at even in the European context, German socialists had to fight to create this idea of class and of a working class, right? That people had various identities and various backgrounds, whether it be the feudal or different ethnicities within the German context, and they actually fought to make class identity, right? It was a political identity. It was never just an ontological identity. So, I mean, so to me, in that same way, where we're actually thinking now, how do we actually break through that, right? I mean, this is, you know, to argue really against sort of those elements and those ideas that there's sort of this ontological sort of universalism, which often usually lends itself to being a white working class, right?
Yeah.
And that's the problem, right? As opposed to saying, no, it is diverse and it is stratified and there are those who are marginalized, but they're not weak. They're organizing, they're constructing new communities of struggle, and they're actually at the center of building a better world. So to me, I think those divisions are often, and what I try to argue in the book, not only false, but they don't help us for any, you know, they keep us trapped in a past understanding and lens of thinking of class.
So, you know, when we're kind of diving in and pulling apart these ideas of race and class and how they can supplement one another, I think you put that very eloquently, that there's a way that introducing the other pieces of ourselves, whether it is race or gender or other identity constructs, can actually make any ensuing conversation about class a richer conversation. I want to jump off from that idea to talk about the way in which labor, particularly migrant labor, to use the term that's used in the book, seems to move so invisibly nowadays, that it seems to be something that is very obscured from the day-to-day in which we reckon with labor. And so I'm curious about your thoughts about how that affects any real dissection of this issue and the people that are center to it.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, prior to the pandemic, you know, before people were considered unsung heroes or essential, were just invisibilized, right? These were the kind of sectors that migrant labor sort of operates in, were often, you know, lived in the shadows, right? And so for a lot of these migrants, they often were isolated and invisible. You know, if you look at home care workers who work in isolation, who are working, you know, 12 hours a day, some home care workers working 24 hours a day, as in the case, you know, places like New York City, they're invisibilized. They're isolated. They're forced to be isolated. You know, in some cases, in terms of migrant labor, they're not even deemed as workers, right? Deemed as contractors or subcontractors. If you look at the gig economy, right? For example, something I talk about in the book is that things like Uber or Deliveroo, a lot of these workers are misclassified to be autonomous, independent contractors when they obviously work for these large multinational tech companies.
And you know, what's also interesting there, just to jump in real quick, is one of the things that really irritates me about this is that the very precarious nature, you know, it's a word that I use a lot, and you use it in the book, the precarity that underscores a lot of this is often packaged as something that is actually good for the workers, right? That they have the ability to set their own schedule. They can work as much or as little as they want. They have freedom. You know, that's a word that Americans love to throw around all the time. There's lots of freedom. And it's galling, you know, my language, not your language, you're more eloquent than me, but it's galling to see the reality so twisted. How did you square that in your research? I'm sure maybe in Canada it's a little different, but I know Western nations, they love to use the freedom notion, right? Particularly for gig workers.
No, I mean, the concept of freedom and, you know, is compelling. And it's even compelling to workers, right? So a lot of people who might be, especially in the gig economy, even though if they're working 60 or 70 hours a week, it ideologically works, you know, that it's almost by their own choice, right? Well, I'm free to work or not work, but for some reason I have to work 60 hours a week to make ends meet. But there is this ideological sort of trap that's set by particularly in the gig economy, that you have no boss or that you're autonomous, but you're compelled to work further, more, you know, and more as opposed to less. So this idea of freedom and time, I think, are essential. And I think that's one of the things that we saw post-pandemic that workers are beginning to struggle with, right, is the idea of winning back time, right? And that we should think about the, you know, freedom as being the right to our time, right? And so with the gig economy, you actually see workers are being less free, right? Because they're working longer, and these platforms have ultimate control over their time through the rates they charge or lowering the rates that these workers will take per delivery. And so there's quite a bit of control. And that's something we see that is being challenged in Europe, but not in the North American context. But I want to go back to the invisibility thing. One of the key ways this labor is deemed invisible is through our construct of citizenship, right? And that is a key piece of it. And so migrant labor is deemed invisible because it's constructed to be invisible, right? And so, you know, in the Canadian context, I mean, also in the U.S. context, is that those who aren't citizens, those without status. So in the Canadian context, we have 500,000, upwards to 1 million people who are living without any status. And in Canada, I would say their situation is much more worse. They have very little access to any services, can't have bank accounts, can't own a home, can't go to a school, can't access any service without their status. And because they're facing deportation, they're forced to live in the shadows, right? They cannot live in the open. They cannot exist. And so as a result, they become hyper-exploitable. You know, in the U.S., you know, there's something over 11 million people who are undocumented. And so for these people, invisibility is a survival strategy, and it's forced upon them because of this idea that there are those rights and privileges for those who arbitrarily have citizenship and status and those who do not.
And that sort of exploitation, you know, hyper-exploitation, as you said, is... It's not new. Like I remember growing up, you know, my family's from the West Indies, and you know, I had aunts and uncles who, you know, we used to call it being straight, right? Like if you weren't straight, you kind of did whatever work you could. And there were definitely times when the people that my family worked for would threaten them with, you know, we're gonna call, like, at the time it was just immigration. We didn't have ICE, it didn't exist, but it was like, oh, we're gonna call like immigration, you know, and that was your cue to, like, you didn't know if that was a real threat or not, right? So sometimes it was a threat to take away your bargaining, you know, as you were looking for more money, you were looking for maybe days off, or for other things. They would, oh, I don't have to do anything because I could just call immigration, right? But if that was a real threat, you had to kind of like drift away from that job, right? You just didn't show up the next day. And so things have not changed. You know, I'm describing a situation in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, right? I would argue if anything, it's worse. So how do we reconcile these multiple realities? I don't even think it's two realities, in the sense that type of labor is essential, not just to these people's humanity and their ability to work, but the actual work they do is essential. But yet their status as human beings, which underpins the work, is based on a forced precarity, right? There is no quick path to citizenship. There is no quick path to having the ability to work from by and large. So you're forced and kept in these situations oftentimes for years. How do we reconcile these types of overlapping crises?
Well, I mean, I think you just, you know, you hit it, you know, in terms of, I mean, the situation is getting worse, right? And it's structurally worse, right? So you think about what's taking place now. I mean, in terms of the migration politics, you know, the last time there was a regularization and amnesty program in the U.S. is under Reagan, right? You know, so in an odd way, Reagan seems to be more pro-migrant than Joe Biden.
And Reagan was horrible,
right? And Reagan was horrible. So you have the borders going out further and further and further, you know, ostensibly saying that the U.S. border exists now between Mexico and Guatemala. You have higher walls. You have more militarization. But you have more people coming. More people are compelled to migrate, right? And it's not actually stopping migration. And this is a big part of it, right? Is that if you look at the Mediterranean, over 3,000 deaths in 1 year. And still people are willing to take that risk.
Which says a lot. Right.
In terms of what, and I think what the West has done to the rest of the world and to the global South, that there's no sense of opportunity or ability for upbringing in terms of the extraction of resources, the extraction of wealth. Thus, people are doing the one thing that they can do, which is to migrate. And I think employers, you know, there's this odd interconnectedness where, I mean, not odd, where it's structural, this interconnectedness in terms of, you know, their labor being essential and also rendered as cheap as possible through these migration policies, through, you know, these employers within these sectors using, you know, migrant labor. Recently, we've been working with a group of workers who they work for a multinational that provide all the food for airlines out of Montreal Pierre Trudeau Airport. And they're all working below minimum wage, undocumented, with the promise of getting papers, and they were left at the whim. You know, if you look at during the pandemic, the ability to try to even recruit in the Canadian context, it was interesting. So even though the borders were closed, Canada was forced to bring in thousands of migrant workers from Guatemala, Mexico, to work in the farms. No matter what the incentives were for quote-unquote Canadian or Quebecois workers, the farms were empty, right? There was no one willing to do that work. If you look at, you know, in a lot of the warehouses that opened up, who were willing to take those jobs, it was immigrant and migrant workers, right? And because employers know this, right? That they were the most exploitable. They're the most, because of their forced precarity, accept conditions that other people wouldn't take. And
you see this, when I read these stories, I think about, you know, the Windrush generation, who left the West Indies to go to the UK after the war. The Turkish folks who were kind of invited, introduced to, incentivized to kind of leave Turkey after World War II again to go to Germany and help rebuild, right? There were no men, no resources. And so you bring in these communities. So the West has had a long history, forced and otherwise, with bringing people from one place to another to do labor. Now it feels so different in the sense that, to kind of bring us back to the class argument, and this is just my very off-the-cuff analysis, I feel like back in those days, shit was fucked up, but there was a little bit more for everybody, right? But now that we're in this, I think, universally precarious situation, I don't know if there's the places that traditionally those from the managerial class or the upper class used to hide are shrinking, right? And so it feels like even those who you would say, oh, you're doing pretty good, don't feel like they're doing good at all. And it's leading to this sort of weird anger and frustration that used to be reserved for folks who were maybe fighting for similar jobs on the assembly line, right? But now they're not in those same, they're not competing directly for work, but they seem to be competing for just the ability to live. And I feel that a lot in New York. So maybe I'm kind of personalizing my situation where the migrant crisis in New York is being played out against this political backdrop of migrants, in Eric Adams, our terrible mayor's word, are going to destroy New York City. You know, if we continue to allow migrants into New York, displaced people into New York, they're going to destroy New York. And this is complete anathema to what New York is supposed to be about, which I find even more striking. So I look at a city filled with money, empty space, and this dude's on TV telling me that migrants are going to destroy the city. Right. So how does that make sense? Help that make sense to me. You're the expert. I'm just a guy. So help me.
I'll give my analysis on it. I mean, I think there's definitely, you know, this protracted period of neoliberal capitalism, which has saw sort of the withering away of the social safety net, which has seen the privatization of services, which has seen the cutback and social goods, you know, whether it be, you know, welfare, whether it be pensions, whether it be all those things that were that mitigated the effects of capitalism have withered away. So have been dismantled. And as a result, you have this, migrants have become a scapegoat. And in a sense, because there's this odd thing where it's a similar logic here, and then, but migrants are at the heart of the housing crisis. Migrants don't receive anything, right? You there has to be an understanding. If you don't have citizenship, you receive very little from the state, right? In terms of the resources of the redistributive aspect of the state. In fact, you know, in Canada, at least, they pay into it without receiving it, right? So temporary foreign workers pay into unemployment insurance, but they don't actually receive benefits. They're legally not allowed to. And so as opposed to blaming, you know, speculative finance in terms of the housing crisis or the reason why we have empty space, which is sitting there simply for investment, you know, there's very little focus on looking at the root causes, which is the freedom of movement for capital, right? And the way the unchecked power that capital has at this moment, right? In terms of, we have not lived in a moment of such great inequality, right? In terms of a gilded age, you know, where employers are shooting themselves into space, right? And Whitey's literally on the moon, you know, and yet, it's Brown and Black workers who are organizing against him, you know, in New York City and JFK 8 at Amazon. And that's where the redistribution is going to lie, right? And so, of course, I think there's this anxiety. I think the pie has gotten smaller for all working people, right? And this is why you have, I mean, I wouldn't call it a migration crisis, right? I mean, because in some ways, in absolute terms, yes, there is more migration, right? There's, you know, if you look at it globally, there's 280 million people who've been on the move. But if you look at it as a proportion of the world population, it's remained the same, you know, 3%, roughly a little above 3%. So what we're told is this construction of a migrant crisis. And I think it's what it's more about is migration on the terms that would give migrants the ability to have a leg up, right? This has always been the question, right? And because even all the controls, all the anti-migrant rhetoric, it's never to close the door on migration. It's to control it, right? On the terms of capital. And so, and one of the things
And it's also the look, right? Like I won't remember the I didn't prepare this as a question, but I remember I read an article on Twitter that was quoting an organizer in Chicago, and the person was saying that Chicago has seen the same number of new arrivals, migrants from Central and South America as it has from the Ukraine. But no one is saying that Ukrainians are the problem, right? It's because, and you know, he went on to say, you know, these are folks who they have services more, their programs more built in now because they are considered to be a nation in crisis. So they have different programs that are ready for them to sort of come in with some assistance. They assimilate easier into certain communities, particularly in a Chicago. You know, you're walking down the street, you can't tell who's who. Things like that, that again, they really, you know, they just strike me as being central to the issue, right? That a country that, you know, putting aside, you know, all the slavery and genocide, right? But from a classical story of America as a place of immigrants, you didn't have all these rules about people coming in and out until the complexion started changing, right? Then we started making different classifications for folks, right? But a lot of these people that critique modern day migration policy, I'm like, your great grandparents didn't have a green card, right? There was no such thing as a green card. They got off a boat in Ellis Island, they checked them for lice and off they went, right? Into the wilds, right? So I can't help but bring in that element of literal race and culture, where some folks are still perceived as invaders, foreigners, no matter what their circumstances might be, and others aren't.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you brought this up earlier too, in the, you know, when talking about West Germany and the bringing of Turkish migrants, and even in the UK, people from the West Indies and other colonies, you know, in France was also the same, from Algeria and Morocco, and into the US was Operation the Bracero program, bringing in workers from Mexico and Puerto Rico. And I think, you know, in terms of migration policy, in terms of race, they're still reckoning with that era. So if one of the things, if you look at, is the immigration reform that took place in the 60s in the US in 65, the Taft-Hartley, there was an openly racist debate in the US Congress, right? Openly racist debate, whether in the US you have chain migration, which is essentially easier for families to sponsor other family members. And at that time, there was debate, do they have kind of a system similar to Canada, which is based on the merit or point system, based on skills and education, or do you have family-based migration? At the time, most migration was from Europe, and why it dropped significantly after World War II, and openly, Congress members being like, well, there can't be any engineers from Africa anyways. We should do the merit point thing. There's going to be no engineers from Ethiopia. And then, you know, saying, well, we got no brown immigrants, so we might as well just have family migration, because it'll be easier to for Europeans, white Europeans, to sponsor other white Europeans. And it blew up in their face, right? And this is the thing, you know, so if you look at Trump's speech, and this is where everyone, you know, the classic migration story of Canada, one that's fair, that's liberal, multiculturalism, is the model the U.S. has been trying to reach ever since 65, ever since they realized it was a drastic mistake in terms of being able to control migration, especially racialized migration. So, you know, Trump said it in his first State of the Union, right? The kind of system that he seeks to build is a merit points system similar to Canada. So you can have a very racialized migration regime, but in the optics seem fair, not racialized, not racist, right? Permanent residency for those who have certain skills and education and language, so i.e. coming from certain countries, temporary migration for those coming mostly from the global south. But the problem is the U.S.-Mexico border, right? And the militarization of the border is really about reengineering the U.S. migration regime to try to look similar to ours. And it's been, and it's not his project solely. I think this is something about, you know, it dates back from, you know, whether it be from Reagan to then continued under Clinton, because it was Clinton who introduced some of the most dangerous immigration reforms. And, you know, even Bush. So there's always been this constant attempt to re-engineer U.S. immigration policy to look like our. So there's always been this, it's discussed differently now. We talk about threats and security, but there's this, there's always been a racialized nature to our immigration regimes, right? And so in Europe, for instance, you know, outside of the extreme far right, but there's always been this fear, you know, a lot of these temporary migrant worker programs in the, you know, that you talked about, they didn't work. So in Germany, there's always been this fear that Turkish migrants never returned to Turkey, right? Or, you know, these Arbeiters. And even the organizing that they did do in the 70s, you know, there was a lot of hostility from German workers, you know, and these workers were fighting for just basic minimum wage. And so there's always this lens of this fear of being invaded by the hordes, even if you invited them, and that they won't return, right? So there's always been this fear of how do you control migration? And it's very much premised on a racist logic.
You know, I want to use that as a jumping point to talk about the notion of, you know, when you're talking about the project organizing on one side to manage this flow of human beings in the service of capital and resources, there's the organizing that happens on the other side. You know, the organizing that work that you're doing, others are doing to ensure safety, to ensure fair wages, equitable opportunities for everybody who's working. And in the United States, it's been a let's call it a banner year for labor, a labor resurgence. How is that sort of organizing moving to confront these new social projects around immigration and migration, but also the logistics and surveillance that happens through particularly tech and how they manage their labor practices as well?
I mean, there's definitely, I mean, the organizing that's taking place now in this labor resurgence, I mean, it's incredible to watch. And it's been, you know, happening, you know, in so many different places and being led by racialized workers, by migrant workers. And, you know, and I think it's taken, the seeds were born, you know, I argue in this wave, you know, a few decades ago, right? And, you know, in the U.S., 2006, you know, a day without an immigrant, really this resurgence of a labor movement of racialized workers, you know, things like the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, political projects here like the Immigrant Workers Center, and that experience after, you know, years and years of tirelessly organizing is finally beginning to make a breakthrough. And I think the objective conditions, whether it be the pandemic, whether it be, you know, the sort of these reactionary social projects that have emerged, I think the organizing that we're seeing is really at the heart of being able to challenge them. And I think for me, this is this new universalism. When we talked about this idea of class being, you know, universal, but it's coding, you know, in terms of the white working class, I think there's a new universalism, right? And in terms of the organizing we're seeing and the level of solidarity, right? So, you know, that you saw in 2017, you know, again, another day without an immigrant, you know, boycott, like this migrant strike after the pandemic in Paris, sans-papier, you know, undocumented, mostly from Africa, delivery drivers went on strike for their status and have won. So challenging these immigration regimes, and not just challenging these immigration regimes, but really challenging this gilded age, right? So if you look at and challenging corporate power in a way, and capital in a way that hasn't been seen for quite some time. So the Starbucks organizing is an interesting example. It's not necessarily migrant at its core, but these young workers have made Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, essentially step down because they just can't stop the organizing. The Amazon labor union, you talk about a resurgence. I know many people on the left have their certain critiques, but you know, a group of young Black and migrant workers came together without resources, without any major union backing them. And they just stood at a bus stop talking to their coworkers for nearly 2 years and took on the impossible and made it happen. And I think that speaks to the kind of the story that people are thinking about their labor again in a really important way. And partly because of the pandemic, partly because they just saw the reality of who got to stay home, who didn't, who had to risk their lives, and who was baking, you know, at the end of the day. And so I think that doesn't go away. And I think also seeing that pie gets smaller, that anxiety gets smaller, that anxiety increase within workers, there's no choice left. Because I think the promises of, you know, just like the we're seeing now this ripping off of the veil of liberal values and liberalism as a sort of an ideology of the West, we're beginning to see the same thing happen in terms of the promise of labor under capitalism, right? That if you just, you work hard and you work full time, you'll be prosperous. You'll be able to live the American dream. And there's just a nightmare, right? And so there is no glass ceiling. The glass ceiling is for all of these workers. And I think that's also a fascinating aspect to it, right? These are the jobs that are just being created. There is no better job. There is no moving up the ladder. There is no, the promise is over and the precarity is just increasing. So people are beginning to see, do you know what? The only way we're going to improve our conditions is to organize with or without big labor.
That's an incredible part of the story. And I'm curious about this as well, because you're seeing, again, this might be a U.S. story, but I believe it is in many kind of Western countries, that there's an incredible shortage of, for example, teachers, you know, those who were considered essential during the pandemic, right? There's an incredible shortage of healthcare workers, right? Particularly the abuse that was, they were heroes at the beginning of the pandemic, but then the abuse is heaped on them later on, right? So record number of people leaving these professions. And again, not wholly a migrant labor issue, but somewhat connected to those issues. I know a lot of the care workers, I saw another piece on this, like many of them are Filipino, again, a place many West Indian people. So it's migratory, not migratory, this in the same sense. Like, how do we see a pushback in those spaces where it's not only tied to these types of policies, but it is also tied to that dismantling of the social fabric of what we're dealing with, right? Like, we don't actually care about healthcare workers, right? We don't actually care about teachers. If we did, they would be compensated and treated differently, afforded different protections, but they're not, right? They're kind of used in this sort of political sense as symbols until they ask for money, then they're not useful anymore. So like, how do we think through that issue? Because it seems to combine everything that you're talking about in the book. It has elements of the migration, elements of the social contract, and elements of compassion, to be honest, right? Like, what kind of future we're trying to build here?
No, and I mean, this is a large aspect, right? Like, where migration is clearly used. You know, you talked about this idea of if we cared about these jobs and we cared about these people, they would be well compensated, right? And that what the state is trying to do, you know, if you can't privatize it, how do you cheapen the cost of labor, right, to make it profitable? Well, migration was simply the way. And it's clear that they have cheapened it so much that there's a shortage, that people are refusing to enter into these jobs, right? And so the idea of the Great Resignation. It wasn't the idea of the Great Resignation. It was a symbol of the crisis of bad, low-paid, precarious work, right? That people were refusing to do. And that was compelling to a certain degree, employers realizing that these conditions were wretched, right, for workers. And so this same thing as well in terms of this migration story, especially in healthcare, when you look at nurses, when you look at personal support workers, when you look at, you know, the hospitals, the cleaners, you know, at the end of the day, it's being subsidized through through migration regimes, right? And and the whole healthcare system is being reproduced on the backs of not just these migrant workers themselves, but their whole society. So if you look at the Philippines, for example, one of the people who writes extremely eloquently about this, talks about the Philippines being a sort of a model labor export state, right? It acts almost like an agency. So, and how the Philippines builds into its education what jobs people will get where they migrate to. So, for example, for healthcare, so the Philippine state actually involves itself in training people as personal support workers, training nurses aides, with the fact that they're not going to support their own people and communities and provide healthcare in the Philippines, but for export. And so this is actually, it's government policy. And this is taken advantage of here, not just in the US, but in Canada in particular also. So this idea that they're going to subsidize this low cost model of healthcare instead of actually taxing the 1%, instead of actually redistributing resources to healthcare by not doing so, by bringing in migrant labor to be able to subsidize that. And so at the end of the day, you have those with precarious status filling those jobs and then being blamed for taking away the piece of the pie, and so there's really this vicious cycle. And I think, but people do have compassion. It's true when people think about their personal support workers or their home care workers or people in the education system, there is this compassion for them. And I think people are sympathetic to them now more than they were before this argument. Well, you're just fat cats on the, public system. I think people are realizing the truth that they're subcontracted, they're outsourced, they're precarious migrants, they're paid minimum wage, they work through agencies, the whole gambit of things where that this is not public sector workers that we used to think of anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. The entire dynamics has changed. What we, I want to get to the final segment of the show, which is the drop. But I think before we get there, one of the things I want to say is we need the freedom of people to be able to move as freely as capital, right? Like if I could send billions of dollars around the world, I should be able to move freely, right?
to move freely and have the same rights wherever wherever one goes, to have the same rights. But that's not what they want, right? They want people to move, but not to be free.
There you go. We need a lot more freedom in this world. That's for sure. So I want to get to the drop, and the drop is just an opportunity for us to share anything at all with our listeners. So I actually have a kind of a throwback drop, which is a book by a woman who I had the pleasure of interviewing. Her name is Candice Fujikani. And so I think it's the first time I'm giving a drop of a person that I've interviewed. Every episode is kind of a drop when I'm interviewing somebody. But I want to highlight her book again. It's Mapping Abundance for a Planetary Future. And she is a scholar who is Hawaiian, though not indigenous Hawaiian, but associates herself politically and culturally with that group, has really done stunning work on how to think about mapping a more abundant future and uses Hawaii as that backdrop. And it's a place that obviously has been in the news somewhat recently with the terrible fires that have run through parts of Hawaii and devastated communities there, which has only helped to push more indigenous people out. But I always want to highlight the freedom movements that are going on in a place like Hawaii, because so often I think that's obscured. People just think of it as this resort space for them to vacation without realizing that most indigenous Hawaiians don't want you in Hawaii, and they don't want you taking their land. So I want to highlight Candace's work, listen to her episode, but more importantly, read her book. So Candace Fujikane's book is my drop for the episode. So you're up, my friend. What is your drop for us?
Oof. I mean, my drop in terms of a book that's sort of connected, you know, that really think people should check out, and people would, you know, would be the person who wrote the foreword for this book. You know, if you haven't read Harsha Walia's most recent book on borders, you know, and she much more focuses on the U.S. So Harsha Walia, who's been a long time migrant justice activist and organizer, involved in Palestine solidarity, you know, different abolitionist struggles. So for me, she's always been, you know, not just a co-conspirator in a way, but also someone who truly appreciate, who's been able to find, you know, her space and to carve out her space and her ideas, still being outside of academia, you know? And so, I mean, she's someone I would definitely, in terms of a drop, people should really check out her book, Border and Rule, Global Migration, Capitalism, and the Rise of Racist Nationalism, also interconnected to, you know, what we've been talking about today. And she really, you know, maps that moment as well. So to me, in terms of a drop.
Yes. That's a stunning drop. And she wrote a great preface to your book. And I love that book. It's one that I don't think I've recommended it on the show, but it comes up constantly in conversations that I'm a part of. Like you said, she is in this abolitionist tradition that I think is so vital to making the world making a world that we can better imagine and better thrive in than the one we have currently. So I definitely co-signed that drop. Mustafa, brother, I want to thank you so much for making the time to be on the show. You've been patient with me as I've been getting my scheduling together. The book is, again, no pun intended, incredibly essential. It's essential work, disposable workers. It is, if you're touched by, or if you have any compassion for people who are doing their best incredibly trying and forcibly trying circumstances, this is definitely a book for you to check out and spend some time with. So Mustafa, thank you again for being on a deep dive with me. It's been a pleasure.
This has been one of the most wonderful, pleasant conversations and really engaging.
Thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate you. Thanks so much again.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.